Welcome to the HJ Talks About Abuse podcast. In this podcast, we talk about sexual abuse cases in the hope it will assist listeners in openly discussing topics which have been ignored for too long. This podcast is brought to you by the abuse team at Hugh James. We are lawyers, so we do tend to speak about the legal aspects of abuse cases, but we aren't too shy to speak up about the broader issues faced by survivors too.
Hello, podcast listeners. This is Sam Barker from Hugh James Solicitors.
And I'm Alan Collins, also from Hugh James Solicitors.
So for those who listen to our podcast, you would know that we get together to talk about issues in the world of sexual abuse litigation and the law surrounding that. And we try to keep it as a timely podcast and up to date with things that have happened recently and new news. Recently, this week, actually, there's been a decision handed down in the Court of Appeal, which is by the name of R and SB. And this decision, as we find it, is extremely interesting and shows a lot of movement in the law and also might have some knock-on effects to the kind of work we do in the civil area. So we wanted to talk about that. And I guess the best way to start is to give a broad brush overview of the facts that sit behind this case. So essentially, the defendant was convicted by a jury on the 5th of February 2018 in respect of complaints of sexual abuse made by his granddaughter. Now, these complaints were initially made in 2016 when the granddaughter told her counsellor of the abuse, and this was reported to the police. The defendant was later charged in 2017, and there was a trial in early 2018, resulting, as I said before, in a conviction, and the defendant was sentenced to 12 years in prison. Now, this is where it gets interesting. Following the trial, about 4 weeks after the sentence, the complainant went to her family and essentially said that it didn't happen. Now, we don't know the background of this. We don't know how it arrived, how it came to be that she went to her family and made these retractions. But in any event, her uncle, following on from this, took her to see some solicitors where she gave a written retraction of the allegations. So it was in writing. Unsurprisingly, this comes to the attention of the defendant, who appeals his conviction on the basis that it's unsafe because of these subsequent retractions. So, on any view of this, somebody would be sitting back and thinking this is looking pretty good for the defendant who's in jail and coming to this appeal. However, following the appeal, three Court of Appeal judges sitting on the Court of Appeal unanimously reject the retraction made by the complainant and find that the convictions are safe. Now, there's many reasons why they came to this decision, which I won't go through now, but interestingly, one of those was that the statement was too legalistic, which suggests that it wasn't in her words. Moreover, they found that her evidence at the appeal about this statement wasn't credible. So the appeal was dismissed and the conviction was found safe. So we're going to talk about this a bit because this is obviously very, very interesting and a turn of events you would very rarely see, I guess, in criminal courts. And I guess I'll turn to Alan here and ask him, Alan, have you ever seen this before and what's your take on it?
Well, it's a very interesting judgment because the appeal court judges seem to have thought that the retraction that was being made by the survivor, the victim, was just incredible because they seem to think that she may have had sort of second thoughts having seen her grandfather, the defendant, sent to prison for 12 years. Now, in our experience of these cases, it is not uncommon for survivors to blame themselves for what happened and to feel guilty if their abuser is sent to prison. It is often said by our clients, I feel responsible for him being sent to prison. Of course, if you analyse it, the reality is, well, actually, it's the judge who sent your abuser to prison, not you. But it is symptomatic of the way survivors often think about things. It all stems from the sexual abuse that they were subjected to in the first place. So it's quite revealing and also, in a way, refreshing to see that judges were thinking laterally, so to speak, and thinking, well, we think this particular person, this particular victim, has felt guilty and started to have second thoughts, having seen a family member be sent to prison. And of course, you know, someone in the family going to prison has all sorts of ramifications for the family. So you can sort of see in quite clear terms how the judges were thinking.
Yeah, I think certainly you can see a sea change in this kind of case in how judges are looking at and understanding, I guess, human emotion in relation to this, and not seeing this retraction as being something that undeniably shows it didn't happen, but more a manifestation of this emotion of guilt. Obviously, it's a very serious and overcoming emotion that you might have following a family member going to jail when you see it as being your fault. So, look, I completely agree. Refreshing to see that they're taking a different kind of approach to these things.
Yeah, once upon a time, I think it's fair to say that judges would not have gone beyond the retraction and, you know, would have thrown the book at everybody and said, well, you know, this was now an unsafe verdict and the defendant needs to be released from prison. Whereas now what we're actually seeing is judges exploring the reality of what is going on and what has happened. And the case has, I think, further ramifications than just within the confines of this particular case.
Yeah.
And I think we need to look at what this might mean as regards future litigation.
Absolutely. Before I go into that, can I ask you a question? And that is, in this case, we see that the survivor, the complainant, is quite young. Do you think the situation is different if we're dealing with somebody who's, say, in their 40s, and these are about historical allegations?
Well, 2 points. Number one is that, in my experience, survivor guilt is survivor guilt, and you see it in all sorts of situations where there's been child sexual abuse, and the age of the survivor is probably irrelevant. The second point, of course, is that with cases where there is a big gap between the abuse taking place and the survivor coming forward, you get issues as regards the quality of the evidence.
Yep.
And that can feed into problems not just in the criminal arena, but also when victims want to bring civil cases. Here, I think it's quite clear that the judges are saying, well, we're able to form an opinion regardless of the disparity in the evidence or the dispute in the evidence, whether it be real or otherwise. You know, the court is saying, well, a jury heard all the evidence and was satisfied and convicted the defendant. Now we're being presented with a completely different picture. The complainant, the survivor, is saying something completely different. She's saying that her story was a false one. And they're saying, well, we just don't accept that. We're able to form an opinion. So that brings me on to the next point, which is quite often in the cases that we deal with, defendants say there can't be a fair trial because the quality of the evidence has been eroded because of the passage of time, and therefore a fair trial is impossible, therefore the court should kick the case out. This case, I think, says, hang on a minute, let's look at the reality. Just because there's a dispute about the evidence does not inhibit us as judges forming an opinion as to who's telling the truth and who isn't.
That's right. And look, to see it happen in the criminal context where, frankly, the stakes are a lot higher. Somebody's going to be sent to jail. And in this case, somebody was sent to jail for 12 years, deprived of their freedom, essentially. And seeing the judges adopt that kind of view, I think you're right. It could have a knock-on effect as to how we look at limitation in civil cases as well. For the listeners who don't exactly know what we're talking about right there, basically, in civil cases, you need to bring your case by the time you turn 21 if you were abused as a child. That's under the Limitation Act. You need to bring it within 3 years of essentially the offence occurring. But if you're a child, you have until you turn 21. And as Alan was saying, many cases are thrown out on the basis that due to the passage of time, you simply cannot transport yourself back and make a decision about whether it happened, who should be liable. We see that in criminal cases, that often does occur. So, Alan, do you think that this is a discrepancy that is kind of odd between the civil and criminal courts?
I don't see it as a discrepancy. I see it as in a way, a bit of a breath of fresh air, because the judges in the Court of Appeal are quite clearly saying we are able to form an opinion, even though there's a dispute. You know, the complainant has said one thing one day and something completely different the next day. Whereas at first blush you would say, well, the evidence is just unreliable, therefore the defendant's got to be given the benefit of the doubt and the jury's verdict overturned. That's not going to happen. The Court of Appeal said, no, the evidence is clear. We're not satisfied with the quality of this retraction. We're satisfied that the jury's verdict is safe. So if you then transport that thinking into the broader context, I think the case demonstrates that even though in these often very complex cases, because often you don't have witnesses, most sexual abuse takes place behind closed doors, therefore there isn't very often independent witness evidence, the courts are saying, no, we can form an opinion. We've heard the evidence, we've seen the evidence, we've weighed it up, and in spite of this discrepancy, we are satisfied that we can get to grips with the reality. We can form a safe opinion as to the quality of the evidence. And here they've said, yeah, we're satisfied that the jury's verdict was safe. So then moving on from there and dealing with the cases that we often have to bring against defendants, often many years after the abuse has happened or the alleged abuse has happened, this judgment we can point to and say, look at the reality, court. You know, the judge needs to look at the actual evidence and think it through and weigh it up and form an opinion. So if the Court of Appeal can do it in a case like this, judges in maybe less complicated cases get the reassurance that they are entrusted with forming a judgment as to who's telling the truth.
Mm. Yeah, great to see in this case judges adopting a really investigative role and weighing up the evidence as a whole, coming to a conclusion. So I think it's a really interesting topic and obviously a very interesting decision. We welcome any thoughts on any of this that we've discussed today in our podcast. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, and look forward to another podcast next week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of HJ Talks About Abuse. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you would like to speak to Alan or I about something you have heard this week, or even if you would like to suggest a topic for a future episode, please do get in touch at aboutabuse@hjtalks.co.uk.